Hello and welcome to the eighth podcast of the Summer Library. I am Paul Sorrell, along with T.R. Parker. T.R., how are you, my friend?
I'm doing really well. The semester is well underway. I'm happy that everybody's back, and I'm really, really excited about our guest today on the podcast.
Yes, we are very fortunate to have Ray Van Est.
Ray Van Est.
Who is the Associate Professor of Biblical Studies and Director of the R.C. Ryan Center for Biblical Studies here at Union. And Ray has had some health issues in the last few months, and it's just really, really good to see him back.
Yeah, and he's been preparing hard for the King James Version Festival that'll be coming up next week, so it's really timely that he's feeling better. And he has graced us with his presence here on the Summer Library Podcast. So we're excited about that. But there are a few things to talk about before we start talking with Ray, with Professor Van Est. One of those things is that Sunday will be the how many years has it
tenth,
been?
Tenth anniversary.
Tenth anniversary of 9/11, of the September 11th attack on the World Trade Center. And so, Paul, do you remember where you were when that happened?
I do. I was at home. I was eating breakfast, and I walked into the den, and the TV was on. And I remember Peter Jennings talking about something had happened at the World Trade Center, and they started showing video of that, and they showed a jet fly into it. And at first, I thought it was just a wreck. I thought that's a very unusual, you know, for a plane to fly into a building. And then, you know, it kind of dawns on you, wait a minute, this is not just an accident. And then just to watch it fall, and I remember I was getting my oil changed after that, and then I came on into work, and I remember there was a lot of panic, concern, and other things that were on people's faces, and it was just a really, really bad day.
Yeah, it was. It was a tough day. I remember I was in a political science class at Rollins College as an undergraduate at that time. And I just remember sort of the same feeling. But
yeah.
We will be reverent on Sunday to think about that. We've had a new person working with us in the library.
Yes, Anna Dombrowski,
yes.
Who is our cataloging associate.
Yeah, she's from Illinois. She graduated from the University of Illinois, has a master's degree from there, actually engaged to one of our professors in physics, Professor Jeffrey Poor. I don't think they would mind us announcing their engagement on the podcast. And so we're excited to have Anna. She seems great.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And seems like she's fitting right in and doing a great job so far.
Yes, yes. Very pleasant.
Yeah. That being said, there are a few things we're going to – this sort of edition of the podcast is dedicated to Professor Van Est and to the King James Version Festival. I have created a research guide. If you're looking for articles or more in-depth content, even video lectures by the likes of people like Alistair McGrath, it's located at guides.uu.edu/KJV. If you want to find out more information on the King James Festival. It also links to the website for the festival. There is a display that you worked on, Paul, along with your student assistant,
Shanae,
who does a wonderful job.
Mm-hmm.
On the King James Festival just outside the library.
Right.
So that actually display has a book in it by Leland Ryken, who will be here for the festival. We're excited to welcome him and other scholars. Professor Van Est will tell you a little bit more about that. And mm-hmm. if you want to watch some videos or find out a little bit more, there we have a new service in the library called Films on Demand, and it's streaming educational media, films about all sorts of topics from artists, to historians, to literature, to science, medicine.
It's a very cool database.
Very cool database.
Yeah.
Check it out from the library's webpage. There are posters around campus as well. Films on Demand. Check it out from the library's website, or contact one of your friendly research coaches to check that out.
That's right.
Let's take a break, Paul, and then let's come back and let's talk with Professor Van Est. How
we'll
does that
do
sound?
It. Okay. Ray Van Est next.
We'll be right back, people.
We are back. Thanks for staying with us. We are with special guest Ray Van Est, and Ray is the Associate Professor of Biblical Studies and Director of the R.C. Ryan Center for Biblical Studies. And Ray, We are really glad to see you. How are you feeling these days?
Much better. About ready to be back in classes in the next week and feeling a whole lot better.
And you've grown a beard.
I have. Couldn't shave while I was in the hospital, so just let it go for a little bit.
Looks nice.
It looks very nice. Yes.
Thanks.
Yeah, we can't tell you how honored we are to have you here on the podcast, and honored to see you in the library today. Everybody, the entire campus has been missing you and thinking about you and praying for you, so we are glad that you are in good spirits. We like your beard, and we're happy to have you on the show today.
Thank you very much.
So we're just going to get into asking some questions. What did you have, actually? I mean, you were in the hospital for a time. And,
that's right.
And what exactly was...
In the end, they're not sure what I had. Okay. I was in there for 2 weeks and then was told to remain at home to recuperate for 2 weeks. But all the blood tests came back negative, so they could not determine what it was.
Wow.
That's scary.
That is, yeah just the mysterious, all of modern medicine. And they, at one point, Professor Worley had mentioned that it was possibly Rocky Mountain
spotted fever. Yes.
But that turned out to be not the case.
That's right. Okay. There were a few leading candidates, including that one, that they thought it was, but the test came back negative. They thought so much it was that disease or another one. They ran a second, more thorough test. It came back negative as well, so we're not sure.
Well, we're so glad you're here and you're feeling better. Are you excited to be back?
I am. I'm very excited to be back and to be back in the classes and just going back along regular role of things.
I know. I've had a chance to see a few of your students in courses that some of your colleagues have been kind of taking over until you're back, and they're all missing you, and I'm sure they'll be excited to see you as well. As a matter of fact, I just saw a student in the library who was excited that you'd be back. And now, what classes are you actually teaching this fall?
I'm about to be teaching elementary Greek, Pauline epistles, and sophomore seminar.
Okay.
And I just say on that, I am very blessed and really appreciative of my colleagues who have stepped in, and they have plenty of other things to do and all their own other projects, but they've covered these classes for me, and I've been very thankful to them.
Yeah, we have an excellent group of faculty here, and I'm sure they were happy to do it. But we're happy that you're back. Now, I was just sort of in preparing for this conversation, just sort of looking over your bio and looking over a bit of your history, and we did notice that you were a Union student.
That's great.
If you don't mind us dating you, we're not gonna ask you out tonight or anything like that. It is Friday, but we wanted to kind of get a chance to find out when you were at Union, or maybe around what time, and
sure.
And what that time was like for you when you were a student at Union. It's a very different place, maybe.
It is. It's a very different place. I came in the fall of 88 and then graduated in 92.
Okay.
I finished in the December, actually in 91, but at that time we didn't have a December graduation, so I had to wait to walk in May that followed. Mm. The library was in the same place. It looked very similar as far as the basics of it. And the faculty obviously has changed a lot, though there are a number of faculty who are still here, who were here at the time. Dr. Bedelford led a weekly Bible study in his house that was influential for many of us, and of course he's still here. And one of the key blessings to me at the time was the student community that was here, and I'm blessed in that way as well, that a number of those people I got to know then who were dear friends are still around, some of them working here at Union. So.
Were you from the area? Were you from the area? Is that one of the things that influenced your decision to come to Union? Or?
Yes, I'm from West Tennessee.
Okay.
I was from just north of Memphis, so
okay.
That played a part.
Great. And, that's exciting, and we're glad that you came back to us. Now, I noticed that then you went after that. You went on to Trinity Divinity School in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what can you tell us a little bit about what made you go there and what that – just a comment about what that experience was like?
Yeah, that was a great time. I actually had gone to another school and began to rethink where I might go. Most of the authors of the textbooks I was reading were at Trinity, and so we took what was for us at the time a crazy step of going. Tuition was about 10 times what we had been paying. We were going north of the Mason-Dixon line into that dangerous area,
Oh, yeah.
But it ended up to be a great blessing. People told us that my wife would not be able to get a teaching job. So we moved in on Saturday, and she signed the contract on Monday, I believe, and ended up pastoring a church up there. So it was a great time.
Okay. And now, speaking of our great colleagues, I know that Professor Ben Mitchell, who was actually covering one of your classes, was involved with that school as well. Did you all cross paths during your time in Chicago?
We did not.
No,
he came after I was gone.
It's a big place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you went north of the Mason-Dixon line to that dangerous day, and then you went even further north and all the way across the Atlantic, where they speak funny and it's cold and rainy all the time, I hear.
That's right.
You went to do some doctoral study at the University of Aberdeen. Can you just tell us a little bit about what you studied and why you made that decision to go a little boy from West Tennessee goes all the way over there.
Right.
How did that come about?
Yeah, the main draw there was that Howard Marshall was professor of biblical studies there at Aberdeen. And as I was finishing at Trinity, Grant Osborne, who was my supervisor, had studied with Howard Marshall. And he was at the time still considered one of the leading evangelical New Testament scholars. And so the chance to study with him was the main draw.
That's great. Yeah. And so you moved at that time where you moved your family, or you moved your
That's
you
right.
and your wife went to Scotland and mm-hmm.
Went with two children, came back with a third. So
oh wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So does the third have dual citizenship then? Are they Scottish or American? Or,
well, we thought that might happen, but they had changed the laws, so he doesn't. It is interesting. We went for academic reasons, thinking this would be good preparation, and it really was. But when we came back, we really believed that the greatest benefit was to our family, just the opportunity of being in another place, a different culture, and seeing things, and learning and growing. So it was a dear time to us. Mm-hmm.
To develop sort of a different perspective and see other Christians
That's right.
in other parts of the world and just other cultures and how that can work can really be impactful. That's really great. And then you came back to Union to teach.
That's correct.
Now, did you was that straight away, or did you make other stops along that road? And how did that work out? Because you know,
that's a fun story actually. In the year, there was a year between when I was in the area of Trinity and I went to Scotland. We were planning to go to Scotland, and then I had a call, which for me was out of the blue, from Dr. Guthrie. They had a position that was all of a sudden vacant. They needed someone to fill it for a year. And so I tell people they must have come looking for me because I was safe. One, they knew me. They knew I was going to say something really strange. And they knew I was going to do doctoral work, so I wasn't going to try to push this into more than just a year. So I came to Union and taught for 1 year before going to Scotland. And at the end of that year, before we left, they told me they would hold a place for me. So that was a real blessing while I was doing doctoral work to know there was a job to come back to when most of my friends were scrambling, you know, trying to find one.
Sure.
So that was a real blessing.
Wow. So you just then came right in and you've been here ever since. And that's been how long now?
Including that 1 year, I think I've now been here for 11 years teaching.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, I think that's one of the strong things about Union is that we retain our staff and our faculty for quite a while, and people come and they realize how special the community is and they stay. So, well, that's great. And I noticed that you also keep a blog. We've kind of noticed that, and that's you started that in 2005. How's that going, the blogging? You've even been doing some blogging while you've been not feeling well.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned what year it started, because I would not have been able to remember that myself. So I'm really enjoying it. I have two, one main one that you're referring to, and then there's a link to a smaller one. I find it's helpful to me as in part of the writing process in general. There are a number of things I've ended up writing that are basically pulling together pieces that I put together for blog posts along the way. The main one, Oversight of Souls, is primarily devoted to aspects of pastoral ministry. And then the smaller one that's linked off of that is the Children's Hour, which is on children's literature. Mm-hmm. It grew out of our own reading to our kids at home and people asking for recommendations, so I began to just put them all there. So it's a lot of fun.
This topic sort of came up the other day in Professor Green's class, and we were talking about research. And so I'd like to kind of pose that question to you in you know, with the coming of the digital era. I mean, we've both come up in times through our education when things have gone from print to a lot of digital resources. And then so now there's sort of a blurry line between what is scholarship and what is not.
Right.
How do you view blogs in terms of, I mean, when you're researching yourself, with, you know, or doing research on other faculty members or scholars, and you come across a blog, I mean, how do you look at that? Do you just use it for reference or?
Yeah, I think it depends a lot. If the blog is coming from a reputable person, mm-hmm. then that means a lot different. You have some blogs that are no more than someone's opinion site when it may be that very few people are interested in that opinion.
Or, right.
Or attack sites even mm-hmm. on certain people or things. But then there are names that you recognize and you see their material. I still wouldn't use a blog post even from a recognized scholar, I don't think, in writing, you know, to
sure.
reference something.
Yeah.
But usually what you have there is they mention something that sends you to the actual resource, mm. or you see they're beginning to work on this and you can follow their line of thinking. So I suppose in reference in that sense is probably how I would use it. But one of those standard maxims that came about long before there was a digital age I think still applies. Consider the source.
Right, you know. Right, yes. Well, that's really helpful as we think about information in this age, and it's part of what we do in the library, and I'm sure part of what you do as well. So you're feeling better. You're back. We've got a big event coming up. Tell us a little bit about so we've got this festival coming up, the King James Four Hunt King. What is the actual title of the festival? I see it's
yes. KJV 400 mm-hmm. Legacy and Impact.
Yeah. And that's coming up just next weekend, Thursday, yes. Friday, and Saturday. Is that right?
That's correct.
And we've all been looking forward to this and a lot of preparation. So we want to kind of just ask you a little bit about that. In your time at Trinity and in your time at Aberdeen, you know, when did you get interested in the, you know, how did you get interested in the King James Version?
Yes. My interest would go back further than that.
Okay.
The King James is the Bible I grew up with.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting. This doesn't go straight across age lines because it's also cultural issues, but I would guess that apart from some smaller areas where the King James still is the main translation, that maybe about my age is the last when there were people regularly growing up with the King James as the translation they knew. But it is when I did Bible drill as a kid, and we memorized all these verses. They were all King James. So when I teach here and I just quote a verse off the top of my head, oftentimes it's actually the King James that I'm, while I'm saying it, changing thee and thou and a few things. When I was in college, I memorized a number of things in the NAS, and so sometimes either one. But oftentimes, even over this last year, as I've been thinking more about the King James, I've realized that much of the scripture in my head is that.
So that's really interesting to me. You actually grew up with the King James Version. So if you don't mind me asking, was that something from your parents, or was that your denomination or your church in particular? Or
sure. Our church, the pastor preached from the King James.
Wow.
It's what we had. We had other Bibles in the house. Mm-hmm. I read some other Bibles. But it was the air we breathed.
Wow. Right.
And I'm a few years older than you, so I understand perfectly what you were saying, because my father was a pastor, and growing up, it was the King James. And I think the first, and this wasn't a translation per se, but it was a paraphrase, the Living Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember when that came out in the 70s and how some people were up in arms about, oh, you're messing with the Bible. Some people liked it because it was more related to a modern way of speaking and talking. But yet the King James was the de facto version of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like we've gotten away from that a little bit compared to what it was with us growing up.
That's exactly right.
But with the King James, I mean, it's 400 years old. So how did that particular version come into existence?
Yes, that's a question that a number of people are talking about this year as this anniversary. In the early 1600s or the late 1500s, there was a debate about Bibles. You'd begun to have English translations. with John Wycliffe and then William Tyndale. Actually, there were some even before that, but they'd become popular. The Bishop's Bible was the standard Bible. You can tell by the name. It was the official Bible. But then the People's Bible was the Geneva Bible that had been translated by some English exiles in Geneva. It was the one that most people liked. Even some of the bishops used it. It was the first study Bible. It had study notes in it to help people. Some people around here have seen the copy of the Geneva Bible that we have in the Ryan Center. But those study notes also made it problematic because the study notes in various places spoke against tyrants. The translation itself used the word tyrant far more than some of the others had. That's fine and good unless you're the king,
right?
And then you don't like that. And so there was a bit of there was a clash. The Puritans liked the Geneva Bible. The established Anglican Church liked the Bishop's Bible. Elizabeth had been queen for many years, and in her declining years, things had gotten a little rocky as people were wondering where we were going to go next. When she names James as the king, when he is really just first coming to the throne, there's a petition that comes to him asking him for a number of things on the behalf of the Puritans. Since he's grown up in Scotland, they're thinking he's on our side. He's had a good Puritan upbringing. But he sets out a course very clearly to be independent, and he insults both parties, tries to put them in their place, and says no to everything they ask for. But they had one little almost offhand request towards the end about a new translation, and he seized on that. Said, let's do this. And so part of the aim was to be a unifying factor, to try to bring both these groups together, which is interesting that a project intended for unity, which wasn't terribly successful on that account, in the fact that within 35 years you had a major civil war. But long term, the King James Bible was one of the unifying things about English-speaking Christianity.
Right.
100 years ago, 50 years ago, whatever, when you had all your different denominations, they still were using one text.
Right.
So it's interesting. It didn't have the immediate effect, but long term it did.
And do you think those are some of the things that have contributed to the fact that it has lasted and endured for 400 years?
I think that is part of it. The beauty of the language, no doubt, is a piece of that as well.
Sure.
James is very proud of the book when it comes out, but it's not necessarily a success right away as far as acceptance. That's the way things go. The new thing takes a while to catch on. But then eventually it really catches on, and people speak of the power and the beauty of the language. It's important, though, to realize in that the translators themselves aimed at what they called a plain style. They were not looking for ornamentation or anything like that. They wanted to be clear. They did intentionally use language that was already archaic. We think about the King James being archaic. Some of the language was when it appeared in 1611 because they were they weren't innovators. That's a big deal in their preface as well. They are intentionally trying to take from many good translations to make a common one. So they're using older language. But in doing that, they landed on a style of beauty and power. And it was intentionally produced to be a language that would be read publicly. That's why there's a heavy punctuation in it. When they went through it, they would even read it out loud to see if it sounded right. So I think that attention had a lot to do with it. And in fairness, the English language was at a state of flux. And so when you had a book printed, it made things standard. So the King James and then William Shakespeare, who's right about the same time, become the two primary shaping factors of English. So the fact that it came along at that time in history probably also plays a part.
And at that time, too, England was beginning to surpass Spain and and other European powers as the global power.
Yes.
And that helped to spread its influence, I'm sure, as well.
And there's an interesting thing on that, that because it comes right at that time, there's a video I watched recently, a brief one from the mayor of London, talking about it comes right at this time. So as the English Empire goes to every corner of the globe, and so the famous saying about the sun never sets on the British Empire, when it does that, it takes the King James Bible with it.
Right.
Because it is the book of the empire. And so it becomes a global book, having impact all over the world.
Just like now, we see it in disarray to some extent, but we have the global Anglican communion.
That's right.
All over the world. Well, that's just fascinating. Thank you so much. Do you think that with all of the various translations today, because I was surprised when hearing that you were raised with the King James Version, and you know now I can't keep track of all of the new the new translations, and you know, the NIV and the ESV and then the Message and all the other things that are coming out and other lesser known ones. Is it still relevant today? Is the King James Version still relevant today? Has it diminished in importance? And then will that relevance continue on? What was the King James anniversary like 100 years ago? What will it be like 100 years from now?
Right.
And so I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
Sure. That's a great question with lots of good things to comment on it. I might first take the thing about what was it like 100 years ago to establish that in some sense the influence or the place of the KJV culturally is waning. 100 years ago, we're in 1911, and the discussion of the 300th anniversary is really everywhere. Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, who were gearing up for presidential runs, both give significant speeches devoted to the place of the Bible and the King James. Roosevelt even says, he's talking about our English Bible, and then he pauses and says, of course, by that I mean the King James Version, because that was the Bible. From something like 1650 up until the early 1900s, if an English-speaking person said the Bible, they meant the King James, unless they were somebody who knew Greek and Hebrew, but just that's what they meant. So it was a real big deal all over the culture 100 years ago. This year, it's really a marginalized issue. You find it in some academic institutions, in a few church settings, but not many church settings even. So we see that in some sense, the place of the King James culturally has waned. However, I think the primary thing in that is the fact that the place of the Bible itself in English-speaking culture has diminished. The King James actually still has a prominent place in literature, whether it's – and sometimes just totally secular writers using language from the King James. Some of the key voices on the value or the importance of the King James as far as literature and beauty of language actually come from unbelievers. Christopher Hitchens, the prominent atheist, has written some things in this year about the value and importance of the language here. So there obviously is a shift. I think it's devoted more to the decline of the Bible in general in its place. I think the King James still is important to us today, taking up another piece of your question. Not important in the sense of an argument for the King James only. In fact, I think it's sad that when I introduced the topic today, most people are thinking either, if you're talking about King James, you either got to argue that it's the only translation, or you got to argue that it's not the only translation. That's the only thing to talk about. And that's sad because there's so much more that's here. But I think the King James will continue to have a place for several reasons. One, there's a lot to learn simply from the work of the translation, what they did and how they went about it. I think there's a lot of lessons for us today about doing translation there. And that's larger than we could pursue at the moment probably. But then just the what happened in history. This is a moment in history where what the church does leads the culture for three centuries at least. The world around when it's writing literature was shaped by what the church did. Today, most often, what the church does is shaped by what the culture is doing. So surely there's something about this moment in history we can look to say, how can we turn this back around where we have the church leading the way instead of following? So I think this will continue to be relevant in a lot of ways, though its place changed. It's not going to be the reigning translation again, and I'm not arguing that it needs to be. But I would argue for English-speaking Christians to have no exposure or awareness to the KJV is a loss of our heritage.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was just going to kind of expound on that a little bit. In 1982, the new KJV was released, and I think in 1994, another carnation of the KJV was released. So in regard to the new KJV, what is your opinion on trying to tweak, I guess, the King James Version, which we have had for so long in its, you know, original form? What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, there are a lot of historical things built into that that people don't realize. For example, the King James that you and I grew up with and that people may pull off the shelf in the library is not the 1611.
Mm.
It's a fascinating story here, and there's a couple of books that come out this year where you can read this. But from the beginning, there were printing differences because you're not dealing with the kind of printing we know right now.
Right.
So even establishing what was the original text of the King James is a significant scholarly enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So you've got all these things. You've got some misspellings. You've got different things like that. But then you begin to – since you have that, you have some corrections.
Mm-hmm.
Those begin pretty early. Then you had in the 1700s, and the exact date is escaping me, an effort now to bring all this together. Because you had a couple of those things. You had a couple of different printers and all these things happening. So in the 1700s, there's this effort to standardize, and it works fairly well. What we normally have as the King James is that 18th century now text that was standardized. All that to say, revisions then have been inherent from the beginning.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we'd be in a tough spot to be bothered by that.
Mm. Yeah.
I attended a paper on the KJV in Chicago this summer at the ATLA conference, the American Theological Library Association, and they mentioned something about a he version and a she version. Is that some of the things that you're referring to?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then there was the Wicked Bible.
Okay. Right.
They accidentally left out a not, so you ended up with "thou shalt commit adultery."
Right. Right. I heard. Yeah. Yeah. I did hear that. Yeah.
The printer got in serious trouble for that.
Sure. Yeah. Hopefully he kept his life.
He did.
Good. Okay.
And I bet his wife didn't like that either.
Right.
She began to wonder.
Well, Paul, did you have something?
Well, just one other thought with these revisions and these tweakings. And it comes to my mind that there are some who are in the camp that the KJV is the only true version or translation of the Bible, and a lot of those are obviously in the Christian community.
Right.
How do you address someone who is almost zealous to the point that, you know, unless you are studying the KJV, you may not be a real Christian or something like that?
Yeah, that is difficult and unfortunate because it just skews the whole conversation. Someone sent me a picture taken on the interstate, I think not far from here. They saw this vehicle passing, so they took the picture. On the back of it was a sign that said, King James, the Bible God uses.
Yeah.
That's a bit exalted, isn't it? The way I would speak to a specific individual would be shaped by lots of, you know, things. But in general, pointing out, you know, we didn't even have the King James for 1,600 years,
right.
And God was at work apart from that. Pointing out it's not the original English Bible, and even that is drawn from the King James is drawn from several other English translations. The biggest issue, really, though sometimes more hard to discuss, is that we have older and better Greek and Hebrew manuscripts now than we did in the 17th century, which is not surprising. And that doesn't make a huge change. It's not that somebody reading the King James is not going to have God's word, but they're new discoveries. And so it becomes difficult anytime you put any translation as the final.
Right.
There is a group that has their doctrinal statement. You know, we believe in the inerrancy of the scriptures or whatever, which, you know, I would affirm readily. And the standard kind of statement, evangelical statement about this is inerrant in the original autographs, the Greek and Hebrew manuscripts. This group's statement says something about inerrancy of the Bible as contained in Greek and Hebrew and the King James Bible.
Mm.
Wow. But there's some differences between.
And I'm sure they weren't referring to the wicked version.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
Because they'd be in trouble.
I don't know if they mean the 1611 or the 1700s.
Right.
Or,
yeah.
So it usually is a lot of rhetoric
right.
that gets built up in that. And it is unfortunate because then you speak to that, and then somebody else says, that's right, and they heap up a lot of condemnation on the King James, and then I push back the other way. No. We don't have to idolize it or vilify it.
Right.
We can appreciate the work of God. Mm.
That's really well put. Thank you for that. Now, I'm sure there's been a lot of preparation. We've known about this festival coming up for some time. Can you tell us a little bit about the preparation for the festival and what's been done kind of leading up over the past year or even 2 years to get ready?
Sure. There has been a lot that has gone on. It really began with an email I received from a Union graduate in pastoral ministry who was then serving in a church in Kentucky, Justin Wainscott, who is now here in town at First mm-hmm. Baptist. He emailed me, and I don't know exactly how long ago now, and said next year or 2 years from now, it's going to be the 400th anniversary of the King James. It'd be really neat if Union had something about that. And honestly, prior to that email, I had not even thought about it. But it's exciting to me now to think about the impetus for this came from one of our graduates, and it came from somebody pastoring one of the churches. And so with that, it began to stir my thoughts and decided for the Ryan Center would be a good place to initiate this. We began the preparation of inviting speakers and thinking about what this would look like. And one of the key things actually came from conversations with Hal Poe, whose thoughts have been very influential on this, with thinking for this to be not just a series of lectures, but to have those, but to try to broaden it where it touches all of life. This is where the festival then comes from. Mm-hmm. That language came from Ben Mitchell, actually, of thinking about the Bible in general affects all of life. Some things we do are only intellectual, and that's okay, but for this event to have the cognitive side, to have the music side, the drama, the art exhibit, the Bible exhibit, which is visual again, to try to just demonstrate this whole picture. That's been fun to see that come about.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's really come together. Obviously, your illness must have made you a bit nervous, like not a timely thing, but seems like it's all come together, and you seem incredibly calm now that it's here.
It seems to be falling the line, and a lot of people have done a lot of work, and Brian Dinker particularly has held the fort down over these weeks when I've been away, and not just held it down, but has advanced it and kept things going.
Yeah, gotten to know Brian a little bit, just a dear, dear man.
Yes.
Here it is. It's next weekend. Just tell us a little bit about who's going to be here. I see that there are three major scholars in the evangelical world coming, and tell us a little bit about just about some of the details.
Sure. It'll begin on September 15th on the Thursday. And a new thing that's not in the printed material people might see is that since the Bible exhibit we have really took off, it grew even from our original plans and has received a lot of attention, we've been able to set up a time on Thursday afternoon from noon to about 4:30 for external people, so non-registrants for the conference, to be able to come and view the Bible exhibit. So that portion then will begin at noon on the Thursday. We've had people from churches, schools, universities, from Memphis and Nashville calling us about this because it really is a significant event. I was speaking to another journalist yesterday who just kept going on about this and saying, so you mean here in Jackson, people can come and see an original first edition of the King James. We don't have to go to Boston. We don't have to go to Oxford or something. It's going to be right here. And I said, that's exactly right.
That's incredible. Wow.
Yeah.
It really is. A friend of mine who's in the Bible collection and display said, I asked him, I really don't like hyperbole. So I said, how significant is this for our area? He looked at the list of what was coming and said, he didn't know of any other Bible exhibit this year that would be more comprehensive than this one. there is an exhibit in the Bodleian Library in England. He said, really, the only thing that exhibit will have on this one is that those copies were owned by kings and queens who were involved, but that this would stand up to anything else. So that was exciting to me.
Sure, absolutely.
We want to make those opportunities for other people to come.
And this is free for the Union community, right?
That's
I've noticed
right.
that around campus. They don't get to eat the meals, but
that's right.
But, you know.
That's right.
But they do get to see the Bibles and see the art and the drama and the lectures. And
that's right. They can come to the plenary lectures. They can come to the breakout sessions. I should say something quickly about those. You asked about Timothy George, who's a prominent church historian and a good friend of the university, will be here for the first lecture talking about William Tyndale and his influence of really getting things started for the King James. And then John Woodbridge, another prominent church historian who's been here, been our scholar in residence before, will speak in chapel on the place of the King James. And then the last two plenaries are by Leland Ryken, probably the leading evangelical literary voice today from Wheaton. He's written a wonderful book on the legacy of the King James that I had a chance to read and write a blurb for, but he will speak twice on the impact and some of the questions you were talking about, endurance and these kind of things, he will speak to. We'll also have a movie, a film, nicely done from the UK. On it will tell the story, some of the questions you asked, too, about how did we get here. It does a good job of telling the story and bringing that along, showing you some of the places, the actual places where things took place. We can't take you there, but the film is another part of that breadth where you can see the locations of some of these things and experience them. Then our own faculty are set up to do just a wonderful job of talking about how the King James has had an impact on a wide range of areas. One of the things that I don't think has shown up as much in the other books, a lot of books published this year, some other conferences, is how the King James has affected such a broad area of life. Many people talk about theological impact or literary impact, and we're going to do that too. But we'll have people talking about the realms of political science, philosophy, biology, hard sciences, art, education, culture, social work, poetry, just many, many things. And this is our own faculty. Part of what has excited me about this all along the way is we talk about the integration of faith and learning. Here's an opportunity to see it in practice.
Right.
One issue, which is about faith and learning, and seeing not just the School of Theology and Missions speak to it, but to see people from this broad range of disciplines all speaking to this one issue, this will be one event that demonstrates or illustrates this aspect, this idea that we espouse. You can see it in practice in this event.
Yeah.
And all of this gets started this coming Thursday, September 15th. Is that
right? Correct.
Through September 17th.
That's correct.
And will it be in different locations on campus, or is it just going to be in one central location?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. Most of it will take place in the Grant Center.
Okay.
The musical evening will take place in the chapel. There's a play that will take place in the theater. The regular chapel service will be in the chapel. But everything else will be in the Grant Center.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry. Except the breakout sessions. They will be in the PAC building at C&D Hall.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Great.
So a great event coming up for not only the Union community, but the area. And you've done a lot of hard work, and it shows. And a lot, I know you don't do things by yourself, and I'm sure you've had a lot of help from a lot of folks.
Indeed.
But as the point person, it all, you know, you're kind of the face of the event.
Sad to say.
You have the beard. It's great.
Yeah.
You've done a great job.
And
I'm sure that people will be blessed coming out. And we certainly have been blessed for you spending some of your time with us today. And we just appreciate you and appreciate what you do for the university, and appreciate you coming and spending some of your time. And it's really good to see you. And we're glad you're back healthy.
Thank you.
And I know you'll want to probably get some rest
this
this coming weekend and then next weekend after the event. But we appreciate it, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here. We can't thank you enough. Yeah.
All right. And we will be back shortly just to wrap things up right after this. So please stay tuned. we just want to thank Ray Van Ness once again for joining us. And there's a lot of information there and so much more we could have talked about, but unfortunately we don't have hours and hours. A lot of interesting things, and if you want to find out more about the King James Version of the Bible and
go
how he came back, go to the festival, talk to Ray, come by the library,
check out the research guide, or check out a book. We have plenty of books on the King James Version. And so we just want to finish up by just thanking Professor Van Nest. I can't say how grateful that I am that he's, A, feeling better, and also has graced us with his presence. And we'd also like to say that the summer library is where studying every day could help you perform better academically. See you next time. Thanks for listening.
See ya.